Chapter 10. Cannibalism. "I've got a problem," said the full-bearded young hippie. "I'm a cannibal." The policeman who'd just arrested him looked at him incredulously. The man reached into his pocket and pulled out a number of small bones. "These aren't chicken bones. They're human fingers." The conversation sounds like something out of a bad horror movie, but it took place on the afternoon of July the 13th, 1970, near Lucia, California, and the speaker was 23-year-old Stanley Dean Baker. The case had started 2 days earlier, when a fisherman saw a human body caught in the reeds of the Yellowstone River, north of the Yellowstone National Park in Montana. When police waded into the river to recover the body, they realised that this was no case of drowning. The corpse was clad only in underpants, and it had neither head nor arms. The legs had been severed at the knees, and where the heart should have been, there was an ugly hole in the chest. Later in the day, a coroner established that the man had been stabbed 25 times. The absence of the heart suggested disturbing possibilities. Ever since the Manson case in 1969, California had been plagued with a rash of ritual murders, drug-ridden devil-worship cults that offered human sacrifices in the manner of the ancient Incas and the Aztecs. On Monday morning, the police received a missing person report on Peter Schlosser, 22, who had driven off on Friday afternoon to camp in Yellowstone Park. He had been in a yellow sports car. This sounded as if it might be the victim. The police put out an alarm call for a 1969 Opel Kadett car. In fact, the car was involved in an accident at about the time the alarm went out. Taking a corner on a dirt road too fast, it ran headlong into a pickup truck. The pickup was dented, but the sports car was almost a write-off. The driver of the pickup suggested that they should drive to the nearest garage and send for a tow. The two hippies who had been in the sports car went with him, but while he was in the telephone booth, they disappeared, running towards the nearest woods. Half an hour later, it was established that the damaged sports car belonged to the murdered man. The hunt was on, and it ended quickly and anticlimactically when a patrolman saw two bearded hippies on a dirt road and ordered them to bend over his car with their hands on it and radioed for help. It was as they were driving into the Monterey police station that one of the men remarked, "I have a problem. I'm a cannibal," and confided that he had a curious longing to eat human flesh ever since he'd received electric shock treatment for nervous disorders at the age of 17. According to Stanley Dean Baker, his companion, Harry Stroop, had not been involved in the murder. He had been alone, he said, when Schlosser had offered him a lift on the previous Friday. All camping sites in the Yellowstone Park had been full, so they drove a few miles north and camped on the banks of the Yellowstone River. Schlosser had no suspicion that his companion was a homicidal maniac and a devil worshipper. In the middle of the night, Baker shot his companion twice in the head with a .22 and then stabbed him again and again with a hunting knife. He then cut up the body into six parts, severing the head, the arms and the legs. Baker alleged that he cut out the heart and ate it. Then, dropping a few severed fingers into his pocket, Baker threw the parts of the body into the river and drove off in the dead man's car. In his possession, when he was arrested, was a paperback book, The Satanic Bible, a handbook of devil worship. Baker also stated that he'd been on an acid trip shortly before the murder, having taken 65 doses of LSD. The murder brings to mind the case of the Sydney mutilator, William MacDonald, a homosexual sadist who killed at least four down-and-outs in the early 1960s. MacDonald also described getting up in the middle of the night and stabbing a sleeping man in a frenzy, and MacDonald attributed his fits of insane violence to a severe emotional shock in his teens, in this case, a homosexual rape. But MacDonald, who was found to be insane, did not eat any part of his victims. His frenzy of destruction did not carry him that far. What is suggested by a comparison of the two cases is that cannibalism is a form of ultimate destruction of the victim. When headhunting tribes in New Guinea eat their conquered enemies, the act symbolises total conquest, total contempt. The enemy is not only defeated, he is digested and then excreted. It seems possible that the motive for the Yellowstone murder was Baker's hatred of the thoroughly square and respectable young man. Schlosser was an employee of the Muscle County Welfare Department at Roundup, the college graduate with his sports car, his horn-rimmed glasses and his elaborate camping equipment. If this is true, it underlines one of the most disturbing trends in American crime in the 1970s. A trend that may be said to have started with the Manson family murders, the tendency of groups who feel themselves to be social rejects to lash out violently and irrationally at the respectable members of society. The civilised response to cannibalism is always one of violent disgust. Alfred Packer, of whom we shall speak in a moment, and the Mignonette survivors, who ate the cabin boy, aroused a public reaction of horrified fascination that was out of all proportion to the crimes committed. And this could well be because the thought of cannibalism stirs up deep atavistic memories in human beings. There can be little doubt that our remote caveman ancestors were cannibals. In 1927, anthropologists discovered the remains of Peking man, half a million years old, near Chukotien in China. They also discovered humanoid skulls that had been split open and the brains extracted, suggesting that Peking man was a cannibal. Similar evidence has revealed that Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon man, Homo sapiens, was almost at times a cannibal. And in fact, this is logical enough. Unlike the great apes, man has always been a flesh-eater, and one of his earliest discoveries was how to wield a bone club to crack the skulls of his enemies. Since all food had to be hunted, what's more natural than that our ancestors should have eaten their enemies? Later on, when tribal customs and superstitions developed, men began to entertain a magical belief that to eat any living creature was one way of absorbing its qualities. So, in many tribes, old people were eaten, rather than simply buried, because their children wanted to inherit their wisdom. The Greek historian Strabo declares that the tribes of Ireland practiced cannibalism, while St. Jerome reports cannibalism in Scotland as late as the 4th century AD. So we could say that it's only in fairly recent years that civilised man has given up the practice of eating his fellow men. It is quite conceivable, therefore, that the explanation of Stanley Baker's cannibalism is not that black magic and LSD had driven him insane, but that they had released some primitive, long-suppressed urge from his unconscious mind. The horror we feel when we read of cannibalism may be recognition that we are all capable of it. This must be immediately qualified by stating that one form of cannibalism is purely sexual in origin. The Wisconsin necrophile Ed Gein, arrested in 1957, was a sexually frustrated man who had for years been digging up newly buried female corpses, using them to satisfy his sexual needs and eating parts of them. The normal male sexual urge is, to some extent, a sadistic urge. That is to say, it is a desire to penetrate, to violate the female. When a sexually aroused male presses the female violently against him, all his actions are basically aggressive. In May 1971, 24-year-old Wayne Bowden was arrested near Calgary in Canada and charged with a series of rape murders. The first three victims were killed in Montreal. In each case, there were teeth marks all over the breasts. The fourth victim, a schoolteacher, was found in Calgary, 2,500 miles away, on May the 18th, 1971. The odd feature of the case was that in three of the four murders, the victim had been dating her killer. Now, this was no case of a sex-starved psychopath grabbing a girl in a dark street or bursting into her apartment. Bowden was a good-looking, well-dressed, charming young man who would probably have had no difficulty in persuading most girls to satisfy normal sexual desires. But his desire was to use his teeth on the breasts and neck. Some of the Canadian newspapers dubbed Bowden, sentenced to four terms of life imprisonment, the vampire rapist. But it would undoubtedly have been more accurate to call him the cannibal rapist. And in the case of Ed Gein, this cannibal element was taken to the extreme. It is an extension of the normal male desire to wholly possess a girl, and is a common feature of cases of sexual assault. Jack the Ripper claimed to have eaten a kidney taken from one of his victims. In The Sexual Criminal, Dr. Paul DeRiver describes the case of a rapist who, after repeatedly violating his victim, also bit off her nipples and swallowed them. He also cites the case of a necrophiliac mortuary attendant who had for years been violating the corpses of young women. This man frequently inserted a catheter into the bladder in order to drink the urine. He was finally caught because his sexual frenzy led him one day to bite the buttocks of a corpse so violently that the marks were observed by the embalmer. If he had been able to continue to give outlet to his perverse desires, he might well have ended by committing murder and eating the body. America's most famous cannibal was Alfred Packer, the prospector who killed and ate four of his companions. In the autumn of 1873, Packer was one of a party of 20 men who set out from Salt Lake City, Utah, hoping to find gold in the mountains of San Juan. As the winter drew on, they came close to starvation and were saved only by a tribe of friendly Indians. 10 returned to civilization. Another 10, with Packer as leader, pressed on. When Packer suggested that they should make for the source of the Rio Grande, 4 of the men declined to continue with him. These 4 later regretted their decision. Caught in the winter snowstorms, 2 of them died, and the remaining 2 dragged themselves half-dead into the Los Pinos Agency in February of 1874. In fact, they had no reason to envy the others. All but Packer also met their deaths in the wilderness. A month after the 2 survivors had staggered into Los Pinos, another traveller came to the door, begging for food. It was Alfred Packer. And although he was obviously suffering from exhaustion, he looked fairly well fed. Packer's story was that the other 5 men had deserted him when he was ill. The men at the agency had no reason to doubt the story. 10 days later, Packer went on to Saquash and began to drink heavily. He seemed to have plenty of money. The stories he told of his ordeal varied so much that people began to suspect foul play. He was arrested by General Adams from the agency and held on suspicion. On April the 2nd, 2 excited Indians rushed into the agency holding strips of flesh, which they said they'd found outside. They said it was human meat. Packer fainted. When he recovered, he told a strange story of cannibalism. They had been starving in the mountains and were living on roots. One day, when he'd been out gathering firewood, he returned to the camp to find the oldest man in the party, Israel Swan, had been murdered with a blow on the head, and the others were engaged in cutting up the body to eat it. Swan's money, $2,000, was divided equally. Packer ate part of Swan. When this food ran out, a man called Miller was killed with a sudden blow with a hatchet. He was the fattest. After Miller was eaten, it was the turn of a man called Humphrey, then Noon. This only left Packer and a companion named Bell. They agreed not to try to kill one another. But one day, said Packer, Bell had attacked him in a frenzy, and he had been forced to kill him with a hatchet. He cut strips of flesh from the body and continued his journey until he saw the agency ahead, and then threw the flesh away. The next day, Packer led a party back into the mountains, but he claimed he was unable to remember the scene of the murder. That night he tried to kill the man to whom he was handcuffed and escape, but he was detected in time. The 5 corpses were found in June, near the shores of Lake Cristobal. It was immediately clear that Packer had lied. 4 of the 5 had been shot in the back of the head. Miller's corpse was headless. But when the head was found, it was seen that he had been killed with a violent blow from the butt of a rifle. The ribs of all the dead men were exposed. Evidently, Packer's preference had been for the flesh of the breast. Blankets were found in a nearby cabin. Packer had lived there after the murders, making trips back to the frozen bodies for meat. Packer's second attempt to escape was successful, and he was not caught again until January the 29th, 1883, 9 years later. He had been recognised at Cheyenne in Wyoming. He was suspected of being a member of a gang of outlaws. He was tried for the murder of only one of the men, Israel Swan, and sentenced to death. However, at a retrial, he was charged only with manslaughter and sentenced to 40 years in jail. He received a pardon 18 years later and died near Denver in 1907. Packer undoubtedly murdered his 5 companions, and the crime is horrifying. Yet the charge of manslaughter suggests that the prosecution found it impossible to believe that anyone would eat human flesh for pleasure. Packer undoubtedly decided that they would all die of cold and starvation, and that if he hastened their deaths, he alone might survive. This has been the motive in most of the cases of cannibalism by civilized human beings. Certainly, the most moving and remarkable of these was one that took place in the winter of 1972, when a plane load of survivors lived for 10 weeks in the Andes on the flesh of their companions. The Uruguayan plane, en route to Chile, crashed in the Andes with 45 people on board. After 10 days, the survivors reluctantly decided that their only chance of survival was to eat their dead companions. When they heard on the plane radio that the rescue search had been called off, there seemed no alternative to starving to death or eating their companions in order to live. Three of the men climbed higher up the mountain and concluded that the wreck of their plane could not be seen from the air. One by one, the badly injured died until there were 27 of the original 45 left. A landslide of snow half buried the plane and suffocated 8 more of the party, including Liliana Methal, the last woman survivor. Her husband, Javier, was one of the few to get back to civilization. One of the 19 survivors recalled the words of a taxi driver that the snow stops and the summer starts in the Andes on November the 15th. This was October the 31st, and the thought gave them hope. Occasionally they cooked the human flesh, but they had too little fuel to indulge in this luxury frequently. It was near the end of the first week of December that birds circled above the camp, and they realised that spring was at last approaching. 3 more deaths from exposure decided 3 of the men to make an attempt to reach civilization and to bring rescuers. Roberto Canessa, Nando Parrado and Antonio Vincentin set off to climb the mountain. The first steps of a westward route, using cushions as snowshoes. It took them most of 3 days to reach the summit, and when Parrado reached it, he saw nothing but snow-capped mountains ahead. However, far to the west, there were 2 mountain peaks that were not covered with snow. They had only enough food for 10 days, and the mountains looked as if they were at least 2 months' march away. They decided that Vizintin should return to the plain. Then the others plodded on. For another week they continued, down the mountain and along a river valley, and finally the sight of a rusty horseshoe and a soup can told them that they were close to civilization. On December the 20th, 10 days after setting out, they saw 3 men on horseback on the other side of the river. Peasants. The next day, a poor peasant rode up to them, gave them cheese, and went on up the valley to inspect his cows. Later, they returned with him to his wooden hut, and finally, after 10 weeks, ate a normal meal. It was December the 21st. A Chilean Air Force helicopter rescued the remaining 13 survivors on the following day. Of the original 45, only 16 returned to civilization. They had survived largely on the bodies of the other 29. From the strictly criminal point of view, there have been few notable cases involving cannibalism. Fish, Guyne and Stanley Baker were all undoubtedly insane, and it could therefore be argued that they should be regarded as madmen rather than as criminals. But 4 other cases should be noted briefly. In 1897, Adolf Leutgart, a sausage manufacturer of Chicago, murdered his second wife, Louise, and dumped her body in a vat he used for boiling sausage meat. Many Chicagoans still refer to Leutgart as the man who turned his wife into sausages. In fact, this is untrue. He poured caustic potash on the body and boiled it. After a few days, all that remained of his wife were 2 gold rings in the bottom of the vat. However, this was enough to convict Leutgart, who died in prison before he could be executed. He explained the murder by saying that he was possessed by the devil. Fritz Harman, the Hanover butcher who killed youths and sold their bodies for meat, had 2 remarkable German contemporaries, Karl Denker of Münsterberg and George Grossmann of Berlin. Both killers were caught, Grossmann in August of 1921 and Denker in December of 1924, when sounds of a struggle led other tenants to investigate their rooms. Denker was in the process of killing a young journeyman. Grossmann had already killed a girl. Denker's house was found to contain 2 large tubs of brine in which various parts of male bodies were pickled. Denker had kept a detailed record of 30 victims, mostly down-and-outs, whom he had killed and partly eaten. Grossmann, who specialised in picking up young girls, preferably fat, at the railway station, had killed a dozen women and sold their bodies for meat, as well as eating parts himself. Both hanged themselves in prison before they could be executed. The most famous case of cannibalism in the late 20th century took place in Paris on June the 11th, 1981, when a small, shy Japanese student named Issei Sagawa invited a pretty Dutch girl to his flat, then shot her in the back of the neck and ate parts of her body. René, who was 25, was unaware that her polite fellow student was in the grip of a morbid craving to eat human flesh. When Sagawa and his brother were small children, their father and uncle used to play games of giants and cannibals during birthday parties, and the children were placed in a cooking pot. 3-year-old Issy, born in 1949, became morbidly obsessed with the idea of being eaten, and in adolescence this turned into daydreams of eating a woman. So, on that evening in June, he murdered Renee and then undressed and raped her, after which he cut slices off her buttocks and ate it raw, experiencing intense sexual satisfaction. He decided to dispose of the body by dismembering it, placing the remains in two suitcases with wheels and throwing them into the lake in the Bois de Boulogne. His plan misfired when two pedestrians came past and he fled. A taxi driver recalled his passenger with the suitcases, and soon Sagawa was arrested. But a French judge decided he was insane and sentenced him to confinement in an asylum, from which Sagawa was released in 1984 and allowed to return to Tokyo. There, a book of his letters about the murder had made him a celebrity. He became a journalist and a television personality, the only person known to criminal history who has built a successful career on cannibalism.